This week's show brought to you by Ducks Unlimited, an organization that I've been plugged into for, over 15 years now. From the Alaskan wilderness to the Atlantic Flyway, across America's Great Plains and down the Mississippi Delta, Ducks Unlimited has been leading the way in wetlands conservation since 1937. The DU family has ensured the protection of over 16 million acres of waterfowl habitat. Think about that. So come join us. You too can carry on DU's conservation legacy. Visit ducks.org to find your local event and join our volunteer team, Ducks Unlimited, the world's leader in wetlands conservation. This week's podcast also brought to you by Kent Cartridge and the hard-hitting Fast Steel Plus, the latest in Kent's long-standing lineup of waterfowl innovation when it comes to shot shells. Do your four-legged friend a favor and ditch the cripples by picking up a box of Fast Steel Plus available at your local retailer. So tell me what a guy can do to somehow get over you. I'm tired of being all alone. Tell me where I went wrong. I take a drink, I sit and think, and then I order up one more round. Good morning, good morning, good morning. Cable Smith welcoming everybody into episode 723. Of SCI's Lone Star Outdoors Show, presented by Mossberg Firearms. Thank you so much for being here today. It is a pleasure, a treat, an honor to be here talking hunting, fishing, the great outdoors, and all that implies with you. So thanks for dropping by. We've got a great show lined up for you today. I'll tell you all about it momentarily. But first, I'm going to cross something off the old bucket list next week. Headed to Argentina for Red Stag. And the cool thing was, is I vetted every stag outfitter basically in New Zealand and Argentina at the SCI show in Nashville in 2023. I had to book it, you know, you book out a year early for this kind of stuff, sometimes further out than that, realistically. But I wanted to do a free range red stag hunt. That was top priority. And then when El Carrizal, the outfitter I decided to go with, mentioned that they also had Asiatic water buffalo, I was like, yep, I'm your Huckleberry. You're going to tell me you've got really nice red stag, free range, and there's an opportunity to hunt water buffalo? Huh. Yeah, I'm in. And I've got a group of, and when you travel internationally, the people that you go with really make the experience that much more enjoyable. And I've gone to Africa by myself, and then I've gone with people like, you know, groups from 4 to 7 other hunters that some I knew very well, some I didn't. But I've certainly made lifelong friends in that process. And gosh, I think 4 out of the 7 guys that are going to Argentina with me have also been to Africa with me. So we've got a great group. And I will report back next week on how the experience in Argentina was. Great beef and red wine, too. That's what Argentina is known for, among other things. So checking that one off the bucket list. That's what I'm going to be up to. I'm a little torn, though, because I don't like to book other hunts in the middle of turkey season. So that was a conflict for me, but that's when the roar or the red stag rut occurs in Argentina because it's their fall there. So sorry, turkeys. I'll get back to you shortly upon returning. What are we doing today? Let me tell you. You know what to do. Pull up that stool a little closer to the old campfire. Pour yourself another cup of coffee out of Granddaddy's beat-up old Stanley Thermos because we're ready to rock and roll. And today we are talking all things waterfowl with Texas Parks and Wildlife waterfowl program leader, Kevin Cry. And I went into this conversation, I'm not going to lie, with the idea that I was going to beat Kevin up because I took issue with some of the regulatory changes that will affect the duck and goose hunter going forward. Now, as you will find out when you listen to our discussion, that really wasn't it at all. And historically, I've been a huge fan of Texas Parks and Wildlife. I think they do a lot of amazing things. In recent years, I've been somewhat critical. And so if I'm being completely transparent, I thought, hey, maybe they weren't doing us any favors as hunters. And my job is to look out for you and I, the outdoorsmen, the sportsmen and women out there, but also to make sure that conservation and science are what drives wildlife policy. And I think you'll find when we start talking about snow goose seasons and doing away with the conservation order, that's right, there is no more conservation season in Texas. But Kevin will explain why that is. Also, some calendar changes in duck season. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of them. But again, maybe there's a method to the madness that I'm just not aware of. And then maybe even some great news regarding pintails. Wouldn't that be encouraging for the much maligned, what I believe to be most regal of duck species? So much to discuss with Kevin. It's going to be educational, insightful, and entertaining, I believe, as well. Let's knock out a quick break here. And with turkey season still upon us in most of the country, we're going to do another Numa giveaway. It's the combo I wear in the turkey woods, the Renegade top and bottom. The hoodie, it's not like a cotton heavyweight sweatshirt. No, it's light, breathable. It keeps you warm in the cool of the morning and cool in the heat of the afternoon. All you need to do to enter today's giveaway, oh, we'll throw in a Numa trucker cap as well in Kazi camo. But all you need to do to throw your hat in the ring is just email the word gobbler, that's gobbler, to lonestaroutdoorsshow@gmail.com. And you are entered into today's Numa giveaway. Let's knock out a break. Coming up next, we're talking all things ducks and geese with Texas Parks and Wildlife's Kevin Cry on SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show.
Never said too much about home or the bruises on his back. I asked him about him one time, but he never answered back. Yeah, William, you grew up hard and mean.
Hey guys, Gable here. What if I told you you could combine North Texas' best wild game processing with the best archery facility? That's what you get at Cinnamon Creek Ranch. They've been in business 40 years, by the way. My family, my kids absolutely love it when we go pick up our latest wild game order, whether that's a whitetail buck that Henry shot or a nilgai dad shot down on the Texas coast. Doesn't matter. They love the meatballs. The Texas boudin is top-notch. Plus, they've got indoor and outdoor ranges for archery. I love to shoot the 3D range myself, but of course, a full-service archery pro shop as well. You can find it all right there at CinnamonCreekRanch.com.
Run the river, catch a small whale, shoot a mallard as he flies south. Run my dog till I get that trophy for Southern Outdoors.
All right, welcome back to SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show, presented by Mossberg Firearms. This segment of the show brought to you by the 940 Pro Waterfowl. We're talking waterfowl today. This is the shotgun for you. It's the evolution of Mossberg's semi-auto-loading platform. I've beat the crap out of mine for 2 seasons now and have yet to clean it. If it's not broken, don't fix it, right? It's the Mossberg 940 Pro Waterfowl. You can find it at mossberg.com. With that being said, let's talk some ducks and geese. It's my pleasure to welcome Texas Parks and Wildlife Waterfowl Program Leader Kevin Cry back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Cable. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, it has to have been some time because we've never done a video call. I think the last time we did one was on the phone, so that would have been pre-COVID. How long
have you been? It's been a while.
Yeah, how long have you been the waterfowl program leader?
That's a good question. 12, 13 years now, maybe more. Been with the department coming up on 26 years, so yeah.
And before you, it was Dave?
Dave Morrison, yes, sir.
Yeah, Dave Morrison.
He's retired. He's living the good life in Wyoming and enjoying retirement like people should.
Yeah, right on. Well, welcome back. How was your hunting season? Did you have the opportunity to get out much?
Man, it was for probably a lot of the conversations we're about to have. It was a busy, busy year for me. Mm-hmm. The early season was fantastic. I had some really, really good teal hunts, some amazing dove hunts. And then life and the job just caught up to me and I didn't get out much during the regular season. Even though there was ample water on the landscape for, once, it was, something I missed out on, and in future years, I'm going to completely redeem myself with hopefully some of these job things in my rearview mirror. So, yeah.
You live outside of Amarillo and Canyon, so Playa country.
Yes, sir.
And historically, great teal hunting early season.
Can be, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting teal hunting. Unlike, you know, on the coast or even some of the reservoirs in East Texas, you know, the upper end of those reservoirs, you're just kind of, when you show up, what's there is there. There is no movement around the landscape. So you're just kind of kicking the hornet's nest. And when the sun comes up, you pull the trigger a couple times and they swirl around and it turns into mass chaos. And then it's all over as fast as it started. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing, but it could be really, really fun and exciting. It's terrible for a new dog.
Right.
If you're training a new dog, it couldn't be a worse scenario where people are shooting and yelling and you know, it's just mass chaos. But a good trained dog can deal with it. But yeah, it's interesting. Some years it can just be amazing. Some years, you know, you pull the trigger a couple times and they just went over the hill and sat down somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also hell for a young dog is when you don't get to shoot much at all.
Yeah. No, yeah.
I went down to the Pipkin Ranch for the last weekend of the regular duck season.
Uh-huh.
And that's there outside. It's like, you know, close to Anahuac.
Yeah.
And this famous ranch, a buddy just invited me to his corporate lease. I was super stoked. Took the dog down there thinking, we're going to go out with a bang. You know, this is going to be great. We shot 3 ducks in 2 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they had it. Well, they had a bunch of rain, and you know, where the ducks were concentrated, here's all this open water, new water, new food, and they, you know, it was impossible to.
They do that. They key in on those changes in the landscape real quick.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And yeah, they know where the blinds are and the guns are, and they go hide.
Yeah. So she was bored. 3 ducks in 2 days. But
I've had many a day where a dog gets bored and just goes start walking off looking for mice and frogs and things. So sometimes I just said, don't blame them. It's like, you go do what you need to do right now. The birds aren't flying.
So you've been traveling some, because we were trying to get this done a couple weeks ago, but you were, you know, life on the road, duty calls. Were you, where was the job description taking you? Were you flyway meetings or?
Yes, sir. Yeah. So 2 weeks ago, I was in Michigan for what we call the North American Conference, Wildlife Conference. But it also coincides with our spring Central Flyway Council meetings. And so, yeah, we were holding our flyway, all 4 flyways met in the same location, different, you know, at the same venue for that matter, to kind of go over our, spring proposals and business associated with the flyway business. And so, yeah, I was there, and then I get back and immediately have to get on the road a day later to go down to Kingsville to sit on a PhD student's dissertation defense. And then we had a meeting a couple days later in the Kerrville area with our migratory bird specialists and wetland specialists across the state. So yeah, it's been a crazy couple of years and a really, really crazy couple of months. Mm. And literally my calendar is more open right now than it's been in 2 years. So I'm hoping to parlay that into a few turkey hunts real soon.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, so when you're at the flyway meetings, do the Central Flyway guys, when y'all are at the bar, just kind of look over at the Pacific Flyway guys and be like, those guys are losers. We don't hang out with them.
It's funny. I mean, there's definitely a history there. You know, we're 75 years into the flyway business, and you know, I've been doing flyway business for well over 20 years. But there's stories that are told that are kind of unreal, the way business used to be handled, and you know, just even dealing with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I can honestly tell you. In 75 years of flyway business, relations between flyways and with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has never been better. We got a really, really good group of people. We like working with each other. We like working collaboratively. You know, certainly there are differences in a myriad of different ideas and what's going on. But we have a system that really, really works now. And we got a group of people we really like to work with. And I've never been more thrilled to work with this collaborative partnership than what we have right now. So yeah, I mean, those animosities and those discussions.
I said it in jest, but it turns out historically they really didn't like each other.
No, there was definitely some stuff there.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just crazy, the stories how even within flyways, within flyway states, you know, disagreeing adamantly. And, you know, there are stories of the Mississippi Flyway. I don't know how, the entire history, but the Mississippi Flyway literally split. And at one point, Louisiana defected from the flyway years and years and years ago. And so, yeah, there's crazy stories there. But everybody's kind of in a real happy place right now, to say the least.
That's great. And so is this at this meeting, is that where bag limits, regulatory changes, all that stuff is discussed?
We set the table for that. We really don't get into the heavy details and the heavy weeds until our August meeting. So, you know, that'll be post survey. You know, we'll get more data to start, you know, delivered to us, a harvest data, the population data. And so that August meeting is really the meat and potatoes, where, you know, the sausage is made, where we dig down deep and start looking at what the harvest strategies have kicked out, and, you know, for the various species and, you know, the overall frameworks, you know, when, you know, how many days are we allowed, you know, when's the first day we can start, you know, what are the bag limits, those type of things. So that really is an August process. This meeting's a little less formal, kind of higher level umbrella stuff associated with setting the table for that August meeting.
Okay. And are we on the second year of a 2-year cycle where pintail, you know, the limit in the central flyway is one bird, or is that revisited every year?
Probably. Oh no, every year. We have a harvest strategy that has a model associated with it that kicks out the optimal harvest model each year.
Okay.
And very interestingly, we are in the process of revising that harvest strategy as we speak. It isn't official. The products that came from individual flyways 2 weeks ago will be delivered to the service in the next couple of weeks. And then there'll be a meeting that we call the Service Regulations Committee. And two representatives from each flyway will go to this meeting. And actually, it might actually be even a Zoom meeting. But they'll present our products and our recommendations associated with those harvest strategies. And there could be some significant changes in that pintail harvest strategy. It's just too early, because there's
like one that's going to make hunters say yay, or hunters like want to pull their hair out.
Hopefully hunters say yay. Okay, cool. I'll just be very honest and clear here. It's been 20 something years since we did that last, close to 20 years since we did our last harvest, strategy revision on pintails, and with some new, modern, modeling and mathematics and a better understanding of where we lie with that strategy. Ultimately it boils down to we grossly underestimate pintail abundance, and we are, way overestimating harvest. So the reality is, through this new process, it's now taken over 3 years. We don't move fast. That's really frustrating. But, the last 3 years, a pintail working group, which I sit on and represent the Central Flyway, has kind of mulled over this and kind of created a different strategy that will allow for additional harvest. And so we're gonna hopefully dive off into something soon to kind of really kind of test these assumptions. There could be a more liberal strategy moving forward. The one big caveat we have right now, and this is part of a bigger conversation, is that the prairies are in the absolute worst condition we've seen in 25 years. And so we're watching that real closely, even though we might be using a strategy and a new model that might be a little bit more liberal to allow more than a one bird harvest more regularly. If things don't change dramatically soon in the Dakotas and up through the Canadian prairies, it might be kicking back something that we really don't like. Across the board, for pintails, for regular ducks. Yeah, this is one of those aha moments when you start paying attention to what's going on in the prairies and the habitat conditions right now, the habitat loss. You know, we've been talking about this for decades now about continued wetland drainage, continued grassland loss and plowing and turning into crops. You know, just the loss of that
You gotta
habitat.
feed the vegans, baby.
Yeah, the loss of that habitat has just been dramatic, and we just keep saying it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. And ducks, you know, to their credit, really adapted. You know, there's a real big difference in the predator-prey relationship in that landscape. You know, the red fox has largely been removed from that landscape, which was a very, very significant predator in that for hens and eggs nests. And so,
Interesting. And so, what's the reason behind a red fox decline?
coyotes literally have replaced red fox. They don't like each other. They don't live around each other. And red fox are the most prolific duck and nest predator that exists. And when coyotes have rapidly expanded their range, they just push red foxes out. And coyotes aren't a big duck predator. And so, when we used to have, you used to need, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres of dense nesting grass. And they'd go hide right in the middle of that field to build their nest. Now we're seeing nest success rates, even in ditches and along fence rows and stuff. It would historically been very, very poor locations for a nest be successful enough to grow a population. So as we're seeing this loss in grass and seeing this loss in wetlands, seeing all this, you know, ducks just kind of responded and did their own thing and kind of stepped outside the bounds. And every year when we'd have bad habitat, they did just enough. They did just enough. They did just enough to keep going. But we're real, real concerned that the conditions are so bad and we lost so much habitat that this is going to be a nationally elevated red flag moment potentially soon.
So good news on the pintail, but also hold your breath because
Yeah.
that's
But
the
you know,
thing
I mean,
here.
that's the thing. They're resilient, and you know, weather's cyclical, and it takes two or three really good rain events, kind of like we had here in the Panhandle this week. You know, we almost had 4 inches of rain here 2 days ago, which is extremely rare this time of year. And you know, something like that would change everything overnight. You know, as those birds are beginning to approach the prairies as we speak, you know, that would just, you know, key them into being very, very productive. You know, that boom bust mentality and process that, you know, if the habitat's there, they're going to be successful. So yeah, it takes a good, really, really heavy snowstorm or you know, 2 or 3 weeks of good rain, and we're right back in it. So yeah, that it, they'll
So,
respond.
yeah, they will. I mean, we've seen it many times over with our bobwhite quail in Texas. It's like we get in these dire situations, and recruitment's terrible. And then, boom, we get the right amount of rainfall at the right time, and they come back like gangbusters, a truly boom or bust species. Let's knock out a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Texas Parks and Wildlife's Kevin Cry. That segment brought to you by Vortex Optics. Whom last week, I think I've had these glasses about maybe 2 weeks now, but they just released their new line of sunglasses. That's right, offering you the same great VIP lifetime transferable warranty. But you're not going to want to sell these glasses. You're going to want to keep them for you. Absolutely love mine. They've got a couple different models. They're lightweight, durable, obviously polarized, perfect for you know, a day on the boat or a day at the shooting range. Also stylish, so you're not going to look like a dork wearing these things around in social settings either. You can find both the Banshee and the Jackal at vortexoptics.com. Use that promo code LoneStar20 to save big as well. We'll be right back on SCI's Lone Star
'Cause
Outdoor Show.
I've always been a dreamer, had my head up in the sky, just a full-hearted believer, living with no time. If I'm going nowhere, I'll get there on time.
Some say a silenced gunshot is the baddest sound out there. At Silencer Central, we have another favorite. It's the sound of silence delivered to your front door. When you buy from Silencer Central, we handle your application, set you up with a free NFA gun trust, and deliver your silencer straight to you. With an average 90-day turnaround time when you use eForms, buying a silencer is simpler than ever. Visit silencercentral.com and we'll help you get started.
can dry your tears on the telephone.
Lonely East Texas Nights, little Whiskey Myers bringing us back on SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show, brought to you by Mossberg Firearms. Thanks for being here. I'm Cable Smith. We are still talking all things waterfowl with TPWD waterfowl program leader Kevin Cry. We'll get back into that here in just a sec. This segment, though, brought to you by Pneuma Gear for the outdoors. Check it out, the Pathfinder Pant. Whether you are headed to the gun range, to the deer lease, to fill feeders, whether you're going hunting, or maybe just going out for a nice social event with friends, whatever the case, the Pathfinder Pant is durable, it's breathable, it's comfortable in that most important area, fellas. You know what I'm talking about. And yeah, looks great. You can find it at pneumaoutdoors.com. Okay. With that being said, let's get back into it here with Kevin. Coyotes have displaced the red fox, but also these increased agricultural practices means more raccoons.
I mean, there's lots of meso predators up there with skunks and raccoons, and you know, we're getting more and more information about ravens. Ravens are apparently just a nasty, nasty egg predator.
Bastards! I have dove that nest on the back patio.
Yes, sir.
And I don't know if it's the same pair of dove, but every year, so they use this little speaker. And last year they nested 5 times. And so I don't know if it's the same dove doing, you know, having 5 clutches, or if it's multiple pairs, but they always come back.
That's awesome.
But this year we haven't had one successful one so far. And they've tried. Then I would find the other day, I found an egg on part of the pergola where something had taken it out and sat there and eaten it. And I've seen, they're not ravens, they're crows, but same difference, you know.
Right. That's a incredibly intelligent family of birds that is a difficult conversation to have.
So, get the BB gun treatment.
Yeah, they do have protections, but they're incredibly intelligent, and we're seeing more and more of that. So I mean, yeah, it's just kind of like all things leading towards.
Okay, go back to that, because I've heard if they're depredating, or I mean, I've done crow hunts and pecan hunters before.
Yeah. So crows and ravens are different. You can't shoot ravens.
Right. But let's just be clear. I'm talking about crows, not a raven.
I believe the rule says if they're about to depredate, you can shoot.
Well, there's another question. Is the dove mine? No, it's the state's. But so am I, like, I don't know where's the fine line.
It's legal to hunt and shoot crows. That's for sure. Ravens are a different.
I've called in lots of crows with the, it's super fun too. When you turn electronic calls.
Years ago, I did some of that, and it was pretty interesting to see just their behavior and their reactions and their intelligence. That was just so cool to watch.
I thought the dog would turn her nose up at a stinking crow.
She doesn't
discriminate.
She liked it. Okay.
She's like, I'm in.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. No, I have dogs that turn their nose up to sandhill cranes. So yeah, I don't know if they do it with a crow, but that's interesting.
Okay. So let's talk about some of the changes for the upcoming season that were adopted recently. I think the public comment period has closed. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So commission met last, a week ago Thursday. Uh-huh. Was the final commission meeting where they adopted staff recommendations. It's about a week and a half ago.
So let's start with snow geese.
Yes, sir.
What are the changes there?
Did we
do away with the conservation season?
We did. And I'll just start out by saying it was a huge victory. It's a huge victory for snow geese, a huge victory for the resource. And it was not an easy, it was potentially bloody at times, but it was something that staff have been watching for a long time, and watching these trends in abundances locally and continentally. These things were never intended to be permanent. Conservation order is not a hunting season, not a hunting season in any way, shape, or form. It's It's a management tool that is outside of federal frameworks and outside the Migratory Bird Treaty Act.
Can we get a cormorant conservation order?
Well, I am definitely not the person to talk to about that, but there is definitely depredation conversations going on for cormorants.
I know sure. We had on a guy from, I think it was North Carolina, who had they've had a couple where you actually had to go get a permit, but then once you got it, they had a very, you know, a limited season, but you could just stack them up.
Yeah. No, I think there's
you might definitely make some fishermen turn into hunters.
If you yeah, for sure. I've heard these conversations for a long time, and they've evolved rapidly over the last few years. Uh-huh. And I don't honestly know where we stand with it in regards to the general public being able to get permits. But those conversations are taking place, and we are looking for options for that kind of a depredation control. Yeah.
But that's besides the point. Let's get back to the snow geese.
Right. And so, yeah, going back. You know, like I said, conservation order is not a hunting season. And when we sit back and we look at the trends, you know, the responsibilities that we have for the resource, and we're looking at the trends in abundance locally and continentally. And then looking at some of the published literature, and, you know, we're this conversation started close to 30 years ago. And we're 25, 26 years into, active conservation order. And we've learned a lot, a whole lot. And the reality is we were working with different information back then. And the abundances of snow geese locally, very particularly the mid-continent flock, which is the flock in eastern Texas and the Texas coast. That was the flock, very specifically mid-continent light geese was the flock that, scientists determined to be overabundant to the point where they were potentially damaging some of their breeding habitat. Mm. And so that was the flock we were intending to put that additional pressure on to try and curb adult survival rates and increase harvest rates with that those extra measures associated with the conservation order and obviously an extended season or extended days. And since then, we've learned a lot. One thing that people really don't know, we learned this going through the process, but people don't realize that they have experienced, the mid-continent flock of light geese has experienced a unprecedented collapse in abundance from nearly 20 million birds just 15 years ago down to just a little over 2 million this past year. Mm. And so
I'm sure a lot of that is based off of changing agricultural practices, like the Katy Prairie was what's the biggest rice production area in the Central
Florida. That's kind of two different stories there. What I was talking about is the overall abundance of the mid-continent flock. Uh-huh. When you boil it down just to what's going on in Texas, that's another conversation. And that's what we have control of as an agency. And that's what we're assigned with, dealing with. We definitely have had a very well-documented decline in abundance on the Texas coast, that mid-continent flock. It's a large combination of things, but
I cut you off there with the rice stuff. It didn't mean to, but you're saying that it's not as simple as that.
No, it's not. I mean,
would we get from 20 million to 2 million?
Yeah. So that's the continental question. And what's happening is we've had dozen plus years back to back with maybe 1 year or two in between where we've had essentially no production. Mm. There's been no recruitment into the population, basically the very, very few juvenile birds in the flock. And what's happening there is it's tied back to climate change and things that are going on where there's just kind of extreme weather events. And so historically, when we would kind of try and gauge productivity of that mid-continent flock of light geese, it was a very simple equation. It was like, how early was ice out? How early did the snow melt? How quickly could the snow geese get there and start nesting? And when that happened, you would have very good production and you would see 50, 60 something percent of the flock would be juveniles. And, that following year, which we all know, juvenile birds, whether no matter what species it is, are more vulnerable and definitely tend to make for a happier day in the field and more successful. And so what started happening is that ice out definitely has been occurring earlier and earlier each year, but that also correlates to green up is much earlier. And so the timing of hatch when these goslings were hatching historically would be at that perfect time where those green vegetative shoots were emerging and had high protein and high nutrient value. What's happening now is the timing of hatch is occurring earlier, or the green up is occurring earlier, and hatch is a couple weeks behind. And so that those vegetation, that the vegetation on the landscape in the Arctic is matured, and the nutritive value is not there anymore. And so uh-huh. goslings are in poor condition. Couple that with extreme weather events where, you know, they get blasted by a cold rain or a snow event, and essentially it's complete fail of reproduction. And so that's happened year after year after year after year. And so, you know, basically just the population is getting older, and we're not recruiting new. And so when you shoot a million snow geese, that's a million less snow geese. Historically, they would replace themselves. And, you know, in parts of the state or the country, we are shooting over a million snow geese each spring, well over a million snow geese each spring, and they're not getting replaced like they used to. This past year was very interesting. Our Canadian Wildlife Service partners do a reproductive survey where they do flock scans, and they look for productivity and look for number of juveniles versus adults. And they're reporting what they claim was great production, and unquestionably more than we've seen. But, you know, they're claiming 20% juveniles in the flock is great. And to me, that's still very concerning. It takes something like 18% to even maintain a population, let alone grow it. And so we historically used to see 50-60% of the flock be juveniles, and so we're just not growing that flock like we used to. And so that's what we're seeing continentally. You know, snow geese are adaptive. That's the one thing we've learned in the last 25 years. They're adaptive as all get out. All geese are, to be that matter, and so are ducks. But you know, maybe they'll figure things out. Maybe they'll move. Maybe weather will balance itself out. But the reality is, their abundances as we speak right now are below the thresholds that we set in our management plans to terminate the conservation order. And basically what it boils down to is we're the only state that has stepped up to do it so far. And
I'm sure that a lot of hunters and guides will use that against you, or have tried to.
But because we're the only state.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, that was one of the large parts of the conversation. But, you know, again, it's a double-headed conversation, because what's going on in our state is unique amongst any other state as well. We used to be, you know, snow goose capital of the world, and we're not anymore. And so basically what we're looking at is we're looking at our resource that is, you know, was being harvested unsustainably over the last 25 years. We've lost 86% of our mid-continent white geese since the day we started the conservation order. And so what we're trying to do is basically just get control of the resource, continue to put unregulated pressure on these birds. And we are now the only state that has a respite period in the entire country to hopefully start getting these birds to, you know, begin to put fat on and do better at reproduction and
rest
begin
period.
We're the only state in the country that
so
has.
So you mean no conservation season?
Yeah, no, there's no conservation season. So,
okay, well, this is getting really interesting. We do need to table it though. Take a break. We'll come back, continue the snow goose conversation, and then we'll segue into greenheads, because we're not seeing them in Texas like we used to. Maybe they've suffered some large scale population decline, maybe not to the tune of snow geese, or maybe it's other factors, but I'm sure you've got insight on that as well. That segment brought to you by StealthCam. You can find their entire lineup of wireless cellular cameras right there at StealthCam.com. We'll be right back with more from Kevin Cry on SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show.
There was seven Spanish angels at the altar of the sun. They were praying for the lovers in the valley of the gun.
Experience a new world after dark with Armorsight's night vision and thermal optics. Precision meets adventure. Whether you're a hunter or explorer, make the night yours. Upgrade your vision now by visiting Armorsight.com for more information.
Looking for a thermal hog hunt near DFW? Then Three Curl Outfitters has you covered. Offering fully guided thermal hunts just minutes south of Dallas, guide scout daily to put you on the bacon. Using thermal imaging technology to hunt feeders, crop fields, and river bottoms, you get unlimited hogs and no kill fees. Visit www.3curl.com. Also offering corporate hunts and food and lodging available by request. Book at 3curl.com or call 214-455-0940.
Hey, y'all, it's Jeff Foxworthy, and thanks for listening to my buddy Cable Smith on the Lone Star Outdoor Show.
So here I go, packing light, to head down that road. And I know this life will lead, will beat on my soul. But I still have my pride in nothing.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here, Cable Smith. Welcoming everybody back into SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show, presented by Mossberg. We're going to pick it back up with Kevin Cry of Texas Parks and Wildlife's here in just a sec. This segment, though, brought to you by Safari Club International, the worldwide leader in protecting your freedom to hunt. Join our ranks today at safariclub.org. And by the way, thank you to all the Safari Club members already tuning in. All right, well, let's continue talking snow geese here as we've seen a monumental decision made by Texas Parks and Wildlife. Kevin Cry is here with us. Why don't you take us behind the scenes as much as possible? I know you gave us a little bit of an overview, but how did you guys decide to set the precedent of becoming the first state to get rid of the conservation order?
Yeah. It's a long story. We literally 2 years ago as a staff approved unanimously to eliminate the conservation order, or at least proposed to eliminate the conservation order to our commission. And end all hunting on the last Sunday in January, which correlates with the duck season. I thought about that a lot prior to going to the commission and going through that voting process. And I felt like we needed to hit pause, go back to our staff and make sure they had all the options available to them. You know, what was it historically? What are our options? How many, you know, what is the actual federal frameworks that are allowed to us? And then also go to the public and talk to the public about this, introduce the public to it and get their public feedback as well. And through that process and through those scoping meetings, you know, staff reconsidered their original proposal. You know, it was going to stay at 10, end on last Sunday in January, eliminate the conservation order over a year ago. This past year, after listening to public comment, you know, we had two public scoping meetings, and the people that showed up, the majority of them felt strongly that that the conservation order should go away. They felt strongly that there is a need or an interest in reducing the bag limit to 5, and they wanted to use the full federal frameworks. And the full federal frameworks is 107 days of hunting, which allowed us to extend that original proposal of ending the last Sunday in January to somewhere around February 14th. And so that was staff proposal. We changed our minds, you know, after listening. And that was kind of our moment of meeting them in the middle of, you know, we're going to allow February hunting, you know, regular hunting season, 5 bird bag limit is what was approved, 107 full days. And so, yeah, I mean, it was kind of some give and take. But the reality is the conservation order is not a hunting season. It's a management tool that was designed for an overabundant species that new science and new literature, published literature is saying are no longer overabundant. And so we feel strongly that the conservation order is no longer needed in the state of Texas.
So I guess that's the mindset that's probably changed over 25, 30 years is people just look at it as an extra hunting season that we
yeah.
have to participate.
It's not a conservation order, right?
Idea that this exists because these snow geese were eating themselves out of house and right. home potentially, that we lost that. I mean, I don't even think of it like that. I'm just like, oh, cool. Let's go shoot some snow geese because we can.
Yeah.
And it's fun. And so I think that over time, just like anything else, you lose sight of why that existed. And so here's a correction to that. Nobody wants to see snow geese decimated.
No, not absolutely not. Matter of fact, we're the only state in the country that really, really, really wants snow geese.
The other states are like, yes, let's kill them all.
Yeah, yeah. We really
like,
want
fine,
snow
we'll
geese.
Shoot yours too.
Yeah, and that's we really want snow geese. We're going to work very, very hard. This is not a singular action. We have some programs where we're delivering water on private lands on the Texas coast, and that will not be hunted, a true sanctuary roost pond program that we have begun. And it's well funded, and it's going to grow rapidly in the near future to kind of control some of that. You know, we're not just talking out of one side of our mouth here. You know, we care deeply about snow geese, and we want to bring back that hunting tradition. You know, we invented snow goose hunting, you know,
Texas
as I said it often, but you know, they're called Texas rags for a reason. And so when we were given this opportunity by, you know, this conservation order, which was outside of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, we were the only ones ready to deal with it. Texas was the only one ready to deal with it. We had the means, we had the methods, we had the knowledge, we had the tools. And when you look at some of that data, when it started, we had 28,000 participants, hunters in the conservation order in the state of Texas. Huh. We shot a little over 100,000 light geese that first year. The last 10 years, we're down to around 1,000 participants and a little over 2,000 to 3,000 light geese being shot during the conservation order in the state of Texas. A lot of that has to do with just opportunity and abundance. And so, yeah, I mean, the reality of, yeah, we definitely have some landscape level changes. You know, we're trying to address that. You know, there's things outside our control that have to do with agronomics and water supply associated with rice that we can't control, but we have strong evidence that there is habitat out there available that is going unused. And so to sit there and say it has nothing to do with us pressuring birds and putting, you know, staying out in the fields and hunting nonstop year round, whenever they came to the state of Texas, they were legal. And so to say that that didn't have impacts is pretty narrow-minded. And so we're just trying to pull back the reins a little bit and kind of have a more regulated experience. And all we did was literally take the exact same regulations we had in the early 80s prior to the conservation order and return it to that. We just went back to before it was, the way it was before.
Well, interesting stuff on that front. You know, you hear about it going away and your initial reaction is, well, that sucks, you know, and everybody wants to be mad at the biologist, but
yeah,
that's what that's what you're paid to do. Let's do this. I know that was a short segment, but we've got a lot to get into on the duck front. Hunters appear to be up in arms about changes in season dates. So we'll see if you can make that make sense after the break. That segment brought to you by Armasite and the 640 contractor, my favorite thermal optic that I've ever had the pleasure of using. So user-friendly. You can operate the thing in complete darkness, no problem. I sighted it in the other day, 3-shot 0. And here's the cool thing. Pick one up now, and Armasite will throw in 20 free thermal targets. Pretty cool. You can find it at armasite.com. We'll be right back on STI's Lone Star Outdoor Show.
Where the big deer grow.
In the market for a compact track loader? Check out the Bobcat Advantage, where Bobcat track loaders squared off against other brands in a variety of tests and challenges. Whether you're looking for performance advantages, uptime protection, or quality design, Bobcat compact track loaders are the best-built machines in the industry. But don't take our word for it. Watch the videos at BobcatAdvantage.com or see Bobcat machines in person at one of our 9 North Texas locations. Visit BobcatOfNorthTexas.com or call 469-586-0000 today.
Nothing like the sight of a greenhead, or the whine of a mallard hen. A group of geese landing right there at my feet, coming out of my blind. I can't help but grin.
Band Hunters, the name of that one from Walt Gabbert, bringing us back on SCI's Lone Star Outdoor Show, presented by Mossberg Firearms. Cable Smith here with you. Thanks for dropping by. We're about to talk some ducks with Texas Parks and Wildlife's Kevin Cry. This segment, though, brought to you by All Seasons Feeders and Blinds and Trigger Time Kennels in Bonham, Texas. Okay, Kevin, we've had a pretty great conversation so far. Very amicable, as you've explained why Texas Parks and Wildlife did away with the conservation order on snow geese. Makes sense. I am going to hold your feet to the fire now on behalf of all the guides and duck hunters who've reached out to me saying, what is up with Texas Parks and Wildlife? Why are they trying to screw us over by pushing season dates back? So let's get into that now, because maybe you can talk us off the ledge, but I'm personally a little concerned as well. And
we didn't change anything other than calendar progression.
Okay, so I thought that the split actually moved closer to December, or it moved back.
Yeah, that's just calendar progression. I mean, so we have basically a couple of rules that we follow when we start setting these seasons, assuming, you know, the federal framework.
Oh man, you wouldn't believe how mad these guys were.
Okay,
the background is, no, I mean, duck hunters are like, start the season as late as possible, right? Because especially in Texas, we're at the tail end of the central flyway. I'm speaking for me now, not anyone else. I'm like, sometimes I see more ducks in February than I did at any time in the season. But then we have all this, probably scientific stuff about pair bonding, and we have to, and it's a federal thing. We have to end the season by this date. So that's kind of out of our hands anyway.
Yeah.
But if they've already really started pairing off to mate, then as conservationists, we don't want to blow them away when they're doing that. But to start the season, I mean, you have X number of days possible you can hunt due to the, you know, based off the federal framework. And I think every Texas hunter would be like, start it as late as possible, because especially with, you mentioned climate change earlier, and wherever you stand on that, like whether it's agriculture or climate change, I think everyone agrees, like, we're not getting the mallards that we used to get in Texas by and large. I mean, I've been duck hunting 20 years and I shoot mostly gadwall and widgeon now. I don't shoot as many mallards as I used to, and it's because I don't see as many mallards as I used to. So whether it's large populations being short-stopped, whether it's stuff not freezing over, none of that really matters to me. I just know that they're not coming like they did. So let's see if we can get it as cold as possible for as many hunting days as possible. Right. But you're telling me that there wasn't anything that you guys said.
No, we didn't change. We didn't change anything. Yeah. It was we've had the exact same season structures for the last 4 or 5 years for sure. Mm-hmm. And it, essentially all we do is, you know, that calendar does progress and it moves around.
Yeah.
You know, we're, the latest date that we allow hunting in the state of Texas is the last Sunday in January, and that moves. You know, in a couple of years that'll be January 31st.
Right.
And so that bebops around. We have like two rules of thumb when we set that. When we set that season is we need to be open during Thanksgiving break. Mm-hmm. Right. And in the North Zone, we have a 1 week split or 5 day split. That is a very interesting conversation that essentially kind of along the lines you just were talking about, as you know, quote unquote, later is better. And so I did some analysis looking at hunter success by zone a few years ago. And very interestingly, the North Zone hunter success kind of goes kind of intuitively. November being the lowest successful month, December being the second, and then January being the most successful. Right. And so when we set that season, we make sure we're open for Thanksgiving and Christmas and, you know, all the important breaks. We go to the last Sunday in January. We want to take advantage of the most amount of weekends we possibly can in that late season. And so historically we used to have a split that encompassed a full weekend. And so it was a full, 12 day split.
Oh yeah. And that wasn't too long ago.
Yeah. Our staff, you know, debated over this a long time and decided that it's by looking at that harvest data, it's more important for Texas hunters to be able to hunt every weekend in January and December. And so that's what we did. And so, yeah, that calendar kind of bumps around. But probably even more interestingly, when I did the exact same exercise on the South Zone, we're talking about different species, different habitats. These birds use them very differently.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the exact opposite. January was the worst month. December was the second, and November was the best month. And so we try and, you know, we try and put more days earlier in that scenario, open a week earlier than we do the North Zone. And because of the you know, that landscape's very heavily, very intensely pressured and hunted. And so staff feel very strongly, and I feel very strongly that a full 12 day split that encompasses a weekend, you know, where most hunting occurs, is still very, very important for that landscape. And so it's actually quite a simple little equation for us to set that with the current frameworks we have. If we were to go to a 39-day season, which is possible, which used to happen, and I remember hunting in it myself, that'll be a very difficult conversation when we go there. Where are we going to put 39 days? But right now we have 74 days. And so the reality is we didn't move anything. So the calendar might have progressed and Thanksgiving might have moved around a little bit and jumped from one week to the other. But we go to the last Sunday in January and back up, and we do a little bit different things in each zone. But that conversation about later is better is very interesting. Like I said, with that, the North zone, it's somewhat true. But we're seeing some really interesting research. There's a lot of telemetry work going on right now, across the country, people putting these transmitters on birds. There's been a very, very big deep dive into, where birds are harvested, through the harvest, the parts collection process and banding. And there has been, certainly a shift. We see a shift of latitudinal shift and bands. A little bit western shift.
You mentioned
overall. What's that?
You mentioned bands?
Yeah. We use band recovery data to do some analysis.
I don't believe bands exist. I've seen thousands of birds get shot, and I've never been on a hunt where a band in
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, killed. Yeah, they're
so
definitely
to me,
out there.
It's like the flat earther thing. Bands aren't real.
Okay. Yeah, they're out there. We need to ban more birds because
I've seen lanyards of hunters claiming they shot them.
I'm just kidding.
But
for sure, I get it.
The math doesn't add up with how many ducks I've seen,
right?
Taken on hunts. It's like,
well, I mean, it's interesting to say that some of the species you kind of mentioned earlier, you shoot gadwall and widgeon. Mm-hmm. We don't ban a lot of gadwall and widgeon.
Right.
The top two species we banned are blue wings and mallards.
Right.
And so that's kind of where. A lot of our birds are banned. We really, really try and want to ban more species like pintails and scop and those things during that preseason period in August, mm-hmm. which is so important to our mathematics and our modeling to set these seasons. So yeah, and so
but you mentioned
yeah,
telemetry and banding and science is showing.
Yes, yeah, it's basically saying that, you know. Everybody claims later is better, but the reality is we're seeing northward migration begin earlier and earlier every year. Hmm. And it's kind of
that's why it's better if they're coming back.
Well, yeah. I mean, so when you're seeing birds in January and February, you know, obviously depending on the species, it's birds going the other direction. And so, yeah, that's occurring earlier and earlier every year. So when people say, you know, late January, the birds just got here. They certainly didn't get there from the north in most cases. Hmm. And so when you're especially talking about the big green-headed monster, the mallard, that is so loved and sought after, you made a comment a minute ago that is absolutely 100% correct. Our own midwinter waterfowl surveys, our own monitoring, and our own harvest, you know, the harvest estimates coming out of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are all correlating with the same things. Mallards are one of those species that has definitely declined in the state of Texas, much like Arctic geese. They have become, we kind of coined them, mallards are becoming like snow geese. With all the excessive pressure, year-round pressure on snow geese, they become more organized, they've changed their behavior, they've changed their distributions. They have no problem sitting in 70 feet of water on a reservoir in Kansas or Illinois and flying out to cornfields that are 20 miles away when they used to go grub in the coastal marsh. And so those are some behavioral changes that have existed that occurred. In large part due to, year-round unregulated pressure. Mallards are doing something very similar right now. You know, states are getting very creative with their zones and splits and being able to stretch the season out as long as they possibly can. And so there really isn't a strong rest period
and they're also getting shot in Canada too.
So. Oh yeah, no, they're coming down, getting shot, they're going back, getting shot. Now. And so the reality is mallards, our midwinter data is showing it's one of the few species in our midwinter data sets that are showing declines in the state of Texas. And, you know, historically, mallards were very, very tied to Northeast Texas and that landscape, and that landscape's changing rapidly. And then obviously the high plains here in the Texas Panhandle with, you know, that the intense agriculture and playa wetlands that are on this landscape. Big changes in both those landscapes. You know, they're not near as reliable. The water's not near as reliable up here. The irrigation practices have changed. you know, Northeast Texas, you know, we continue to lose our bottomland hardwoods. We have essentially no agriculture left. You know, there used to be peanuts in Central Texas.
I was going to say where I used to hunt a lot in college was Lake Ray Roberts.
Yeah.
And I missed the heyday of peanut production around there. But one of my buddies who's 10 years older than me, he tells me, man, there used to be so many mallards around here because of the
peanuts. Texoma area had peanuts. You get over into that Brownwood area, there was peanut industry, and you know, mallards just keyed in on that. And so the reality is with mallards in the state of Texas right now, with the exception of the Texas Panhandle, but we're so variable up here anymore, you know, the irrigation practices changed. So now we're just completely rainfall dependent. You know, we've lost playas due to siltation and things that have gone on to these systems up here that they don't hold water like they used to. We now have to have extreme rain events to hold water. You know, the corn on the landscape isn't what it used to be. And so we just don't see, it's very cyclical. We don't see the steady numbers of birds up here like we used to, by the hundreds of thousands.
It's funny how things
change. I grew up experiencing, which, you know, it's kind of hard to sit back and watch that.
Because when I first started duck hunting some 20 years ago, we shot a bunch, and I was hunting in Northeast Texas. Mm-hmm. We shot a bunch of mallards and we shot a bunch of wood ducks. Mm-hmm. And I would shoot these birds, and I am a college student at the time, and I'm like, I want to get a bird mounted. Well, okay, that's $200. That's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
Now it's like filling up the truck full of gas. But back then I was like, I got to wait a lot of tables to be able to afford this.
Yes, sir.
And so I wanted a pintail or a widgeon, you know, something what I thought was like more rare or exotic that I didn't shoot a lot of. And we stacked up the mallards and wood ducks. And so now I'm looking back, I'm like, man, I really should have got a mallard or a wood duck mounted, because I haven't shot a wood duck in a couple of years. This was the first season that I've ever gone without shooting an actual greenhead.
Oh, man.
So
it's changing. We're seeing those changes. And the reality is, when you look at mallards, you know, we had a real nice blip this year. We had a lot of water on the landscape here in the Texas Panhandle. We counted a couple hundred thousand mallards up here, which we hadn't seen in a while. Northeast Texas, you know, it kind of largely drought driven. There wasn't a lot of water. What drives duck abundance in Northeast Texas is rain events now. And when we get those flood events, when the reservoirs, you know, climb up above flood stage and flood the backwater, you know, some of that terrestrial vegetation, you know, that's good food. So that's good new country. And ducks key in on that. They can key in on it. Like, we've never been able to explain it, but they'll come from miles and miles and miles and miles away to deal with that, you know, from hundreds of miles away. They just know new habitat is available. And, you know, those bottomlands, when they overbank and start flooding into those, and, you know, those backwoods, which we don't have a lot of anymore, but that's a key feature to bring birds in Northeast Texas. And when those events don't happen, all you have is some, you know, stock ponds, bass ponds, reservoirs that are, you know, pretty old and not productive like they used to be when they were newer. And we don't have agricultural fields. You don't have corn like other places in the country, and, you know, waste grain and peanuts on the landscape. And so when you see a mallard in Northeast Texas nowadays, that mallard has to make a living in the water at which it swims. It has to make a living off invertebrates and bugs and seeds in the water. It can't fly out to a field. There's not a lot of value in you know, a Bermuda grass hay field, which is the dominant feature on that landscape. And so it's just, we don't have the carrying capacity in Northeast Texas like we once did. Other parts of the country have that carrying capacity. Other parts of the country have that rice agriculture associated with, say, the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, or, you know, central Kansas, where they have, you know, continued,
that's, you know, where the best duck hunt I've been on in 5 years was.
Yeah. I mean, they got the food. They got the food and you know, the water, and they've changed their behavior too. The thing about mallards is they're now organized in big, giant, large flocks, like snow geese. Historically, you know, Northeast Texas, when I first started working out there back in the late 90s, you know, there was just little pairs of mallards and three packs and four packs floating around the landscape constantly. You know, it was mallard driven, like you talked about. And mallards just really are in big organized flocks now. And they're all huddled up somewhere together, like snow geese do now. And they are not coming to Texas like they used to. And that's a reality. And so that does have real impact.
Well, thank God for the gadwall.
Yeah. No, I mean, well, that, you know, if you go to the Texas coast, they're saying the same thing about green wings, blue wings, and shovelers. So, but you're right. I mean, those are the species that are very important to the state of Texas. You know,
I'm starting to shoot more spoonies too.
Yeah. Well, they're doing well. They're one of those species that continues to stay steady and strong and even increase in recent years. And they decoy great. And so, yeah, I mean, the old antage of being disrespected is really starting to kind of turn the corner on that species.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and they're beautiful when they're plumed out too.
Oh my gosh. They're especially right now.
One of my favorite mounts I have for sure.
Yeah. Right now they're a late molter, unfortunately. So late in January, you can get some really good ones, but they don't get in really, really pretty plumage until February, March, and April. And so like right now they're in their best. So yeah, I got a handful around my house in this country right now. Then they're just as beautiful of a bird as there is.
Yeah. Yeah. So all of that stemming from me berating you about why did you move the split back?
Yeah, we did it. We really did. I mean, I'm trying to remember the calendar did shift. And so it is a week different where Thanksgiving fell. Uh-huh. And so that's the only thing that would have changed.
So next year it might be going back. Next year I'll look at the calendar and be like, yeah, those jerks moved it back a week earlier.
It was definitely not anything that we're trying to move dates on.
Well, I mean, that's totally, that's, in my opinion, an acceptable answer. And
we just try and take advantage of weekends and holidays. And sometimes the calendar fits what people think looks better than others. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that's all I have for you on the waterfowl front. Are you – now, I know we have a dove program leader.
Yes, sir.
That's not you.
No, that's Mr. Owen Fitzsimmons. He's our webless. Yeah. He oversees all things waterfowl, or excuse me, all things doves, sandhill cranes, woodcock, rails, gallinule, snipe. He's our guy.
Yeah, no, Owen's been on the show a couple times. I'll reach out to him because I know we changed up some dove season stuff as well.
Yeah. There is a few changes there that he'd be really happy to talk to you about.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I appreciate it, man. Thank you for the very detailed conversation and a thorough explanation of what's going on, why we've made the changes. And it wasn't like we just on a whim decided let's change what's going on with snow geese. We're trying to.
No, this has been a decade long conversation that we've been watching very closely.
Appreciate what you guys are doing. And thanks for jumping on. Certainly enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed being on.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
So there you have it, the lowdown on snow geese, what's up with them, and why Texas did away with the conservation order, and then wide-scale changes in mallard behavior. That's interesting. It just goes to show you how adaptable these birds really are. That segment of the show brought to you by John X Safaris and our friends over at Rustic Reminders Taxidermy. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. Gotta go. Gotta get out of here. Thanks to our guest, Kevin Cry, Texas Parks and Wildlife, a waterfowl program leader. Thanks to all of our sponsors for making this show possible. Thanks to you, the listener, for being a part of SCI's Lone Star Outdoors Show. Until next time, I'm Cable Smith saying, y'all have a great week in the outdoors.
Somebody told me when I came to Nashville, son, you finally got it made. Old Hank made it here.